So we have this Italian Renaissance course coming up at PRS, but I think the really strong courses will be the ones on Saturday morning, starting October 1st at 2029 Hyperion. One of those courses will be on symbolic consciousness, and it's almost incumbent upon us in our time, the late 20th century, to be aware in an experiential way and in an intellectual way of symbolic thinking. We are living at the bottom of an ocean of symbolic referentiality, and we are constantly inundated with reference and systems and horizons of meaning that, as soon as we tend to be conscious of them, they tend to inundate us, and we seek refuge in codified habituation, and we seek entertainment in mindless activity like television and so forth. And all of this is just a natural response to the perception of overwhelming meaning. And so the development of a little tactical symbolic consciousness is really a lifesaver. It's wonderful. It forestalls all kinds of situations. And actually, if you go into the affective core of any therapeia, as Jung says, it's the symbolic life that is really the path of individuation, the increasing facility to symbolize, and by symbolizing, shaping one's life and one's consciousness and the energies and so forth. So it's excellent. And then complementary to symbolic consciousness is nature. Only we're faced with an incredible nature. We're not only faced with the flowers and trees, but we're faced with the last decade of scientific discoveries, which have totally transformed nature back into a mystical experience. And it's odd, because tonight we talk about Newton, who was the great mastermind who mechanized nature. And we're in our time, in the 1980s, coming out of that mechanized world picture back into a mystical unity of life based on science. And so these two courses that are going to be offered on Saturday, starting October 1st, are really, I used to call them in San Francisco, image-based survival kits. And that's what they are. We used to reduce, when I had an enormous budget, do just about anything I wanted. We used to reduce illustrations from various books, and I used to write 20 pages for every class every week and hand them out to students on colored paper and everything. And we would reduce images from all these things, and then we'd have about packs of maybe 200 or 300 playing card-sized images, which we'd hand out at the end of the course to get you through the summer. This would be your image base. And it really became something, because all of this is very workable. It's interesting to use tarot cards and astrology and so forth, but when you have your own image base that's substantial, that comes out of an experiential growth pattern, it's much more effective, much more. Well, we come tonight in this course to the second figure in the Enlightenment, Sir Isaac Newton. And it's difficult to characterize the relationship between Leibniz and Newton. They were the two giants of their time, and they represent a real watershed, more so than almost any two other individuals except for Plato and Aristotle. They summarize almost all of the European experience before them, and they leave an impress of integration which lasts up into our own time. But with Sir Isaac Newton, we have a very strange individual. He was odd. His father died, of course, before he was born. So he came into the world almost as a semi-orphan. And even though his mother married again, and he had step brothers and sisters whom he loved, and in fact left most of his estate to the children of those stepbrothers and sisters, Newton was always a loner, more so than an only child would be a loner. We covered Newton in the last lecture of the Hermetic Science series, but I think for our purposes it's well to recap just briefly. Newton was home educated until he was about 12 years of age, which meant that he had a very limited perception of what was available. Then he was sent to a grammar school in Grantham in Lincolnshire, and this village actually had a church which had a very good library up in the attic, which had been left to it by several individuals. And Newton read freely as an adolescent in that library, so that he began to have personal excursions, thinking things out for himself very early on. As a matter of fact, Grantham was also the home village of a man named Henry Moore. Not like the sculpture of our time, M-O-O-R-E, but M-O-R-E. And Henry Moore was the head of a group called the Cambridge Platonists. And in fact, this Henry Moore was one of the great English philosophers of his time, and he was the master of Trinity College, Cambridge. And he came from the same little village that Newton came from. So there are connections. And later on, when Newton would go to Cambridge, Henry Moore took special interest in the lad because he was from his area. And it was on receiving a tip from another Cambridge professor, a man named Isaac Barrow, also a Cambridge Platonist, who had great affinity with Henry Moore, when Newton gave a little mathematical paper to Isaac Barrow. Barrow immediately took it over to Moore, and they realized that they had a genius on their hand, not just an intelligent boy, but a genius. And they sent the mathematical paper off to another great mathematician of their day, a man named John Collins, without telling him who had written it. And Collins wrote back and said that this was really somebody. Who is this? And then they told him that he was a second-year student who had just arrived. So when Moore and Barrow were ready to retire, they made sure that Sir Isaac Newton was given a fellowship at Trinity College, Cambridge. Now, most of the people at Cambridge were actually clerics. They had taken their holy orders. They were ministers. Sir Isaac Newton never took his orders. He was peculiar in his reluctance to formalize his religion. And of course, he had great reason to be cautious because he didn't believe in the Trinity. And this was a very unusual and even dangerous position. But what's more, Newton, in his theological beliefs, was closer to someone like Moses Maimonides, a Jew, than almost any Christian that you could name. And so, in a way, Newton was trying to keep himself clear of the religious entanglements and theological degrees. He could not take holy orders. He didn't believe in the basic tenets of Protestant Christianity, which would have had to have been admitted at that time, and he was too much of a honest individual to have ever perpetrated a lie. Newton, of course, at a very crucial time in his life, became so embroiled with the theological implications of his thought that he was feared to have suffered from a mental breakdown. And many individuals, like the great John Locke and Sir Edmund Halley, for whom Halley's Comet is named, a great many famous individuals tried to visit Newton at the time when he was having his troubles. And of course it was a cause célèbre at the time, and scholars all over Europe were wondering whether the great mind of Newton had snapped. And even Leibniz, when he received communication that Newton was all right, that he was writing again, wrote to his great friend, the Dutch mathematician Huygens, saying, "What a relief it is for mankind that the greatest mind of all time is still whole and capable to write." All of this came because Newton was forced into a position of greatness almost from the beginning. He was discovered at the age of 20 to be a genius. Ways were being prepared for him at Cambridge so that he would not have to take holy orders, that he would be guaranteed a fellowship. And in fact, he took his B.A. in 1665, in January, and then an outbreak of plague. There were recurrent outbreaks of bubonic plague in Europe from time to time, and this outbreak in England took a great many lives. This particular outbreak of plague in Cambridge was not a local phenomenon. It also broke out in London, and the great novelist Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, wrote a book about it called The Journal of a Plague Year, which is an uncannily accurate account of the great city of London in the restoration period of elegance, suddenly seized by the throat by an epidemic of bubonic plague. It's a great book. I recommend it to you for the veracity of the time. Newton, sensing that Cambridge was going to be closed for a term or two, actually it was closed for 2 years, retired back to a little village called Woolthorpe, and at Woolthorpe began going through a period of introspection upon his own experience. And one of the interesting letters of the time shows Sir Isaac Newton writing to a correspondent saying that he was staring at the moon and realized that the enchanting mystery of the moon had a geometrical progression to it, that the moon was surrounded by a whitish ring, and then he said that it was about 3 degrees and gave other specifications, and that outside the whitish ring was a green ring around the moon, and that he noticed that these were going in a mathematical harmonic. And then there was a third ring, which was so far out and yet within the mathematical harmonic that it seemed from him to be an ellipse. And of course, this got him to thinking about the fact of Kepler's laws of elliptical motion of bodies. So while Newton was away from plague-closed Cambridge, he began to think about large universal problems, probably for the first time in his life, in a sort of a dedicated way, the way in which a loner, a genius young man loner, would chew on these problems incessantly. Now you have to imagine to yourself Newton being somewhat, as we would say of an individual today, somewhat neurotic in the respect that he actually worried to death these problems. He was the sort of individual who thought day and night. In one of his letters to John Locke in the 1690s, he writes to John Locke saying, "I'm in terrible shape because I've been unable to sleep more than an hour a night for the last 5 days, and that I'm finding myself on edge about everything. So he was that kind of an individual who could be up for days on end, and of course his mind never went to sleep. His pride of personality was in the clarity and acumen of his mental processes. And yet, with it all, as a human being, as a religious human being, he could not give himself completely over to the accuracy of the world that his mind was delineating. So for Newton, a characteristic of his personality always was his insistence on keeping separate religion and philosophy. Time and time again in his writings, in his letters, in his unpublished manuscripts especially, he refuses to integrate philosophy and religion. He says they are completely distinct, utterly distinct areas. God as a subject is completely distinct from anything philosophical or mental. And for us this comes as a rather shock, because we are concerned with the fact that Newton is the paradigm of the great world system builder, of the integrator of man's mind with the cosmos. For this paradox, we have to then retrace ourselves a little bit. We have to come back to Leibniz. And with Leibniz, we have to come back to Ernst Cassirer's great book, The Philosophy of the Enlightenment, in order to get this in perspective, because actually, the only other mind complex enough at the time to understand this paradox and live it was Leibniz. And in a very real way, in order to understand Newton, you have to understand Newton and Leibniz together. This actually is an esoteric principle. It's not just a simple statement of procedure. It's not a harmless methodological progression. I used to offer, and I will offer later in 1985, the level of course called Parallel Lives. Because in order to understand any form, you have to have a background against which that form can be seen in its shapedness, in its wholeness. And a human being is so complex that the only background which allows the form of the human to emerge is another human being. So that in order to understand the esoteric wholeness of a person, you need another person, and you need to study them together. This, of course, was one of the ancient truths of the Greek mystery religions. And this is why Plutarch wrote his great series on parallel lives. And of course, if you recall, or will recall, or will note, Plutarch was in charge of the mysteries in his day and age. They were not dead in Plutarch's time. In fact, Plutarch tells the story in his Moralia that he was told by an ancient crone in his day that when he was next sailing to Rome and rounding a cape off Brundisium, to yell out to the shore, the dense wooded hilly shore there, that Pan, the great god, was dead. And he said that when he was on board the ship and had yelled this out to this mysterious wooded shore, that he heard a groan of sighs from nature itself that the great god Pan was dead. This was in about 120 AD. So Plutarch is very deep, a guardian of the mysteries, an initiate of the holy rituals. And his notion of the parallel lives is a very profound, meaningful methodology. So to understand Newton, we have to understand Newton and Leibniz together. It's a very, very precocious activity to think that one could understand a complex human being without any referential conditional background. This is why a marriage is such a paradigm, archetypally, of the coniunctio mysterium, because it is two human beings coming together, understanding each other in terms of oneself. So the understanding of Leibniz and Newton together is not just a simple statement, but has within it a very complex methodology. Of Leibniz, Caesar, in his book, The Philosophy of the Enlightenment, writes in here, Leibniz attacked the philosophy of Descartes from another angle, expressly rejecting the doctrine of plastic natures. For although as a biologist and metaphysician, he centers his attention on the phenomenon of organic life, he is very much concerned not to interfere with the great principle of mathematical physics which Descartes had established. In other words, we're going to understand things in terms of the organic whole, but the organic whole is going to have a relationality which is mathematically expressible. The world is a living unity, but its relations are all mathematically expressible. This was the confidence that Leibniz had. Now there's a mystery wrapped up in that. There's a mystery wrapped up in that. And Caesar is going to bring it out for us and display it. And he does it as good as anyone I've ever seen. And so we have to follow this through. If, therefore, the thinkers of the Cambridge School speak of the mathematical sickness of Descartes, the Cambridge School, the Cambridge Platonists, you see, they're saying it's a sickness of the mind to think that you can describe everything in mathematical terms, you see. And yet, ironically, you see, it's at Cambridge, exactly as the inheritor of the Cambridge Platonists, that Newton comes on the scene and does just that. You see the ironies of history working here? Great Beethoven-like sweeping themes, and they're reintroduced exactly at the same place that you would not think. And if they look upon this sickness as a fundamental flaw in his doctrine of nature, Leibniz, on the other hand, stresses the point that the doctrine of life must be so formulated that it does not stand in contradiction to the basic principles of mathematical physics. In other words, there are wholenesses to be experienced and understood, but their expression by human language and their comprehension by the human mind must be in mathematical terms. And Leibniz is seeing no difficulty with this paradox at all, because he has a strategy in mind, which Newton also will have in mind, but Newton will cover up his strategy and never talk about it, whereas Leibniz talks about it all the time and says we can't do anything without understanding this paradox. And Caesar now is bringing us to this paradox. The harmony between the two ways of thinking, according to Leibniz, can only be assured if one realizes that all the phenomena of nature, all the things, without exception, are capable of a strictly mathematical and mechanical explanation. However, the principles of mechanism themselves are not to be looked for in mere extension, shape, and motion, but as issuing from another source. The principles of mechanism themselves are not to be looked for in mere extension, shape, and motion. So we've got a difference between principles and the content things which principles organize and express. We've got two orders. Mechanism is the intellectual compass which guides us along the only sure path through the realm of phenomena, which subjects all phenomena to the principle of sufficient reason. Nothing will happen unless there's sufficient reason for it to happen. And sufficient reason means there has to be some causes, which are mechanical, have a mathematical explanation, and this is the only way that phenomena move and change and have their existence. But there's something else. And that something else is not in that phenomenal order. Kasura goes on and expresses it this way. Which mechanism is the intellectual compass which guides us along the only sure path through the realm of phenomena, which subjects all phenomena to the principle of sufficient reason, and so makes them rationally comprehensible and completely explicable. But comprehension of the world does not achieve its goal by virtue of this sort of explanation. In other words, comprehension of the world is a different order than the explication of the world completely. So comprehension of the all is a whole different order of realization from explication. If you can explain everything, you still do not have comprehension of the all. Leibniz and Newton, both very fundamental on this point, and Kasur brings it out in this way. Such comprehension cannot be content with a hasty survey of the phenomena and with a knowledge of their temporal and spatial order, instead of proceeding from one element of the process to another, which is adjacent in time and space, instead of tracing step by step the various stages through which an organic body passes during its development, connecting the stages according to the law of cause and effect. This comprehension must raise the question of the common ground of the entire series. Now, this will have great fundamental influence, because giants, titans like Leibniz and Newton, understanding that this was a primary realization for man, those generations coming after them completely forgot this. Did not remember this, did not realize this, and progressively the whole influence was that the complete explication of phenomena in their order would be sufficient. For instance, Darwin, evolution. If you could explain stage by stage, every single stage, and the relationship, well, that was it. But they left out the whole notion of comprehension of the all, which for Leibniz and Newton were, let's put it in anthropological terms, without the comprehension of the all, you were dealing with a taboo. Kasur says this, this ground itself does not, however, belong to the series as one of its elements. It's not in the mathematical equation. It's not in the matrix of expressions which can be put into an equation. What is an equation, friends? An equation is such and such equals such and such. The law of identity, the law of contradiction, holds. But it also is a lineal way of expressing that identity. Here's this expression, here's the equal sign, here's this expression. You can make either side of the equal sign as complex as you want, and usually what happens in those expressions on either side of the equal signs are ratios, so that you have something above the line and a denominator below the line. And you might put that in abstract algebraic symbols, you might put it in geometrical inferences and so forth. You can put anything in there. But the basic fact is, even with E equals MC squared, you have the law of identity, non-contradiction, and you have a lineal explication. What you don't have is the context within which that lineal explanation makes sense. And the comprehension is never in the line of thought. It is always in the pattern of wholeness that is transcendent of the line of thought. So that if you think that because you are able to carry a line of argument through from beginning to end, with every step included, you haven't come one whit nearer comprehension. You have only exercised explication. This, of course, is fundamental for Leibniz and Newton. And Leibniz, who was not afraid to synthesize because he realized that he was the inheritor of the Magus tradition, it was up to him to harmonize the world, to unify man's capacities. And like an old hermetic Magus, he took it very seriously. He wouldn't let go of the problems. And he spent his entire life hoping to modulate this. And in fact, he did. It's just unfortunate that many individuals didn't understand it. Newton, on the other hand, also knew this. He was a blood brother of Leibniz, but he wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't say anything about it. It was a hush-hush to him. It was the kind of differentiation that had to be maintained at all times because God was a secret. He thought of God in the old Jewish tradition that don't speak the name of God. You can talk all you want about man's relationship to God, but of the divine, hush, don't say anything because you know nothing. It was exactly this element in Newton's personality that took umbrage against Leibniz's great Protestant mystical metaphysical synthesis. And the great argument between Leibniz and Newton was not on a professional basis. It was not mathematical jealousy, as many people had supposed for centuries. It was on this religious fact that the one was divulging the secrets of the cosmos and the other was keeping it hushed and not stressing it enough, and therefore was raising a generation of mechanistically minded idiots who were going to forget all about comprehension. And of course, Leibniz was, as usual, exactly right. Even today, if you look at what is philosophy at Oxford University in England, they don't talk about comprehension. They say, we have to talk about language and meaning. Is this a glass of water? How do we know that this is a glass of water? Is the statement, this a glass of water, tautological? Can you see? It's worse than a misnomer. It's assuming that because you know how to use a crutch really well, that you should never learn to walk again, much less run and play. This is what happened to the English mind. And it happened to the English mind in polarity to the German mind, which went the other way. And this polarity between the English and German mind comes to the surface in the 20th century with a vengeance. Because it's like the vicious jealousies of sibling minds that want to, if they can't get along together, dominate one or another. And when the V2s rained down on London from the decisions in Berlin, it was like a nightmare of this whole theological argument become a debacle in our own time. A really unbelievable situation. Ernst Cassirer was there. He understood what was going on. He had left Berlin and he went to Yale. He wrote his last book in English called An Essay on Man, just at the time Yale was reprinting his book, The Myth of the State, because he said, modern man is falling into a trap. He is thinking that his mythical imagination, with all of its mechanical exactness in explication, is reality. He's forgetting the whole comprehension of the religious nature of the universe. Because he's forgotten that that was an integral part of the whole situation from the beginning. So in a very real way, when we go back here to Leibniz and Newton, we're going back to the roots of the schizophrenia of the 20th century. This is where it started, right here. This is where it broke. Cassirer then writes with great penetration, a wonderful mind. His best student, incidentally, was an American woman, Suzanne Langer, who wrote Philosophy in a New Key. And then when she finished that, she wrote Feeling and Form. And then she wrote a great three-volume series published by Johns Hopkins University Press called Mind, An Essay in Feeling. She's famous in my book for having made the statement that thinking is an elaboration of feeling. And until you have your feeling integrated, you're never going to understand the integration of thought. You're always limping around on a crutch if you try to integrate your thinking without having integrated your feeling first. The old primitive way that man was always taught was you better learn to dance before you sing, that sort of thing. Before you say what is, do what is, that legitimacy. So Kusura then, bringing this out, he says, instead of proceeding from one element of the process to another, which is adjacent in space and time, instead of tracing step by step the various stages through which an organic body passes during its development, connecting the stages according to the law of cause and effect, before all that, this comprehension must raise the question of the common ground for the entire series. Where is all this happening? Within what is all this relationality developing? What is the all? And he writes here, this ground itself does not, however, belong to the series as one of its elements, but lies beyond it. In order to understand this ground, we must leave the mathematical, physical order of phenomenon and proceed to the metaphysical order of substances. And this is where Leibniz, of course, is a champion, because he says, at this rate, comprehensively, not in terms of explication, but in terms of comprehension, substance is not this. Substance is an event focused by force and essence coming together. And the mind makes this up, that this is substance. But the reality is that it is a focus of force and essence, and that that is exactly what is real. This is only an illusion. So the whole issue of appearance and reality comes right up to the surface abruptly with Leibniz, and of course for Newton also. But Leibniz, because he considered it an ethical responsibility of a lifetime's worth of work, he never married. He devoted himself like a masterful intellectual knight, which he was. He was a knight errant of the mind. Wasn't bothered by the fact because he was committed to it. But Isaac Newton was sorely disturbed at this. Because as he progressed in his explication of phenomena and came to the prideful pinnacle of having discovered the laws of nature, the laws of gravitation, the laws of mathematical expression, and so forth, he found himself writing the Principia. And the Principia, which was written in the 1680s, 300 years ago, set the foundations for physics and astronomy up until the 20th century. It was such a monumental intellectual triumph. Newton was lionized after that. He was made the master of the Royal Society for 25 years. He was made the master of the Mint of England. He was the genius. He was on a pedestal. But the fact was, is that he knew that he was on a pedestal and he was that distant from the real ground, which he knew also to be necessary. And so, it was in the years directly following the writing of the Principia that Newton suffered from what externally was called a breakdown. He had a real problem on his hand. He did not in any way want to be of the devil's party. And remember now, this is still late 17th century, early 18th century. There was a lot of Puritan strain in the English psyche. And it's the Puritans who burnt the witches at Salem in Massachusetts. There was a lot of the feeling of trepidation of transgressing God's laws. There was still that honest circulating. And for Newton, of course, when he was lionized and set on a pedestal and considered the supermind, he realized there was almost no one to whom he could go to ask about things. They ask him. He has correspondence after correspondence. Everybody famous of the time wrote to Newton asking him to solve various questions. Samuel Pepys, who knew everybody, writes to Newton in the letters. I have a volume of the correspondence of Sir Isaac Newton here. And everybody is writing to him. It's interesting here. Newton is writing to one of the great masterful minds of the time, a man named Bentley. And here's how his letter begins. "Sir, the hypothesis of deriving the frame of the world by mechanical principles from matter evenly spread through ye heavens, being inconsistent with my system, I had considered it very little before your letter put me upon it." Can you see the tone? This is 1692. He's 50 years old, and he is the lion of the house. My system. He's writing again to Bentley. "Because you desire speed, I'll answer your letter with what brevity I can. If ye six positions you lay down in ye beginning of your letter, I agree with you. You're assuming that the orbis magnus, that is, the large orbit of the earth around the sun, how wide is it? What diameter is that orbit of the earth around the sun? He's saying, ye orbis magnus of 7,000 diameters of ye earth wide implies ye sun's horizontal parallax to be half a minute. Flamsteed and Cassini have of late observed it to be about 10 minutes, and thus ye orbis magnus must be about 21,000 diameters of the earth wide." And he goes on. Well, it turns out that Newton is very close. It's actually about 22,000. But what this is showing is that Newton constantly, every minute of his adult life, was not only the expert, but had all of this at his command. It wasn't just in his memory, but it was at his touch. He was like a living computer with all of the information ready to hand, and he considered himself to be the authority. So when it came to religious matters, how could the supermind go to someone else and ask? He couldn't. He had to do it himself.